Today is August the 19th, 2020. And this is just a heads up. Next week is Wednesday, August the 26th. And you won't believe it, but it's National Toilet Paper Day. There's always a special day for every occasion. It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The legal case against Qualcomm. Back in 2013, the Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC, alleged that Qualcomm had made significant contributions to technological innovations underlying modern cellular systems, including CDMA and LTE cellular standards. This decision was upheld by a California Bay Area Federal Circuit judge, which effectively destroyed the licensing business model. The Federal Trade Commission that Qualcomm violated the Sherman Act by unreasonably restraining trade in and unlawfully monopolizing the Cold Division Multiple Access, that's a CDMA, and Premium Long-Term Evolution, LTE, cellular modern chip markets. The Federal Trade Commission under the prior administration, in partnership with the Chinese Communist Party-controlled company Huawei, contended Qualcomm protects and profits from its innovations through patents, which it licenses to original equipment manufacturers, and Qualcomm's patents included cellular standard essential patents, non-cellular standard essential patents, and non-standard essential patents. Because standard essential patent holders could prevent industry participants from implementing a standard by selectively refusing to license to international standard-setting organizations require patent holders to commit to license their standard essential patents on fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms before their patents are incorporated into standards. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, 3-judge panel, referred to as the panel, framed the issues to focus on the impact, if any, of Qualcomm's practices to the area of effective competition, the markets for CDMA and premium LTE modem chips. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals began by examining the district court's conclusion that Qualcomm had an antitrust duty to license its standard essential patents to its direct competitors in the modern chip markets. The panel held that none of the required elements were present and that the district court erred in holding that Qualcomm was under an antitrust duty to license rival chip manufacturers. The panel held that Qualcomm's OEM-level licensing policy, however novel, was not an anti-competitive violation of the Sherman Act. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals also rejected the Federal Trade Commission in partnership with the Chinese Communist Party-controlled Huawei case against Qualcomm. The panel held that the FTC did not satisfactorily explain how Qualcomm's alleged breach of its contractual commitments itself impaired the opportunities of rivals, because the FTC did not meet its initial burden under the rule of reason framework. The panel was less critical of Qualcomm's pro-competitive justifications for its OEM-level licensing policy, which in any case appeared to be reasonable and consistent with current industry practice. The panel concluded that to the extent Qualcomm breached any commitments, the remedy for such a breach was in contract or tort law. The panel next addressed the district court's primary theory of anti-competitive harm. Qualcomm's imposition of an anti-competitive surcharge on rival chip suppliers via its licensing royalty rates The panel held that Qualcomm's patent licensing royalties and no license, no chips policy did not impose an anti-competitive surcharge on rivals' modem chip sales. Instead, these aspects of Qualcomm's business models were chip supplier neutral and did not undermine competition in the relevant markets. The panel held further that Qualcomm's 2011 and 2013 agreements with Apple have not had the actual or practical effect of substantially foreclosing competition in the CDMA modem chip market. Also, because these agreements were terminated years ago by Apple itself, there was nothing to be joined. Intellectual property includes the ability to negotiate licensing deals for others to utilize and benefit their customers while ensuring that the person or company which invented the technology receive a contractually agreed upon compensation for their genius. There is no requirement that an inventor must license their product for use by a competitor or cannot engage in exclusive licensing agreements. Unexpectedly, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, 3-judge panel, got this basic principle right in vacating a radical decision by a California Bay Area Federal Circuit judge, which effectively destroyed the licensing business model. This is not just a great victory for Qualcomm, the victim of a prior Federal Trade Commission-driven lawsuit, but for all inventors, effectively affirms that inventors have the right to control their own inventions. It is not expected that the present Federal Trade Commission nor the Chinese government with Huawei will appeal the decision. Google just rolled out a set of new Android features. Ahead of the upcoming official release of Android 11, Google is pushing out a few updates to all Android phones running Android 6 and above, and it includes some helpful updates to Android Auto, a new bedtime mode to help you sleep better, enhance emergency services, and improve accessibility for people with limited vision. For Google, while individually these features might seem mostly unrelated, the goal of these updates is to help make the things that you already do just a bit easier, while also cutting down on distractions, or in the event of an accident, providing emergency personnel with more info so they can respond better to your situation. First, in Android Auto, Google has updated its user interface so that now, alongside directions to wherever you're going, you can see a short list of upcoming calendar appointments so you can keep your hands on the wheel and avoid needing to switch between different apps while you're driving. For appointments that have an associated contact number, Google has even added a built-in dialer button that will let you call someone with a single tap, instead of being forced to dive deep into your contacts. And thanks to a revamped settings app, Android Auto users should have more control over what they see on their car's infotainment display. Alternatively, for people trying to wind down at night, Google is pushing out bedtime mode, which was previously only available on Pixel phones, to all Android devices, which makes it easier to do things like disable notifications after a certain time, set bedtime reminders that will pop up in YouTube either at an exact time or after your current video is done, or choose from a selection of sounds or songs from YouTube Music or Spotify to help you relax before falling asleep. And in the morning, Google also added its sunrise alarm, which turns on your phone display before your alarm is set to go off, gradually getting brighter and transitioning from orange to yellow to help you wake up a bit more gently. All of these new bedtime mode features will be available from a new tab inside Google Clock app. When it comes to emergencies, in case you ever need to call for help, Google is expanding Android's emergency location service to provide emergency personnel with your device's language settings. This should make it easier for first responders to communicate with you when they arrive on the scene or to cases where you don't speak the native language, an early heads up that they may need to find an appropriate translator. Additionally, for all the Californians worried about getting hit by an earthquake, Google has partnered with the U.S. Geographic Survey and the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services to send alerts to residents. Hopefully, giving locals a few seconds or minutes to react and prepare before an earthquake reaches them. Meanwhile, for people living outside of California, especially in places that don't have an existing network of seismometers, Google is giving Android phones the ability to be part of the Android Earthquake Alert System, which turns modern Android phones into a mini mobile seismometers, which when combined creates what Google is calling the World Quake Detection Network. In the event there is seismic activity, your phone can send data to Google's earthquake detection server with coarse info on the information of the shaking, which Google can use to determine where an earthquake is happening and then surface that info in Google. Finally, for anyone who is blind or visually impaired, Google has added new features to its Lookout app, which uses computer vision to help people with everyday activities. One major upgrade to Lookout includes a new feature that lets people scan in documents using their phone's camera and then making that info easier to process by your phone's screen reader. Using the new food label mode, Lookout will help guide the user's hands to better position the camera so that Lookout can read the barcode on packaged foods and more accurately describe the product. And with the new scan document mode, visually impaired users should have an easier time taking snapshots of things like letters and receipts, which can then be sent to a screen reader tool. Google has even upgraded Android's native screen reader, TalkBack, with a more accessible design that should make it easier to center text on your phone's display and an updated UI that should be easier to use while also requiring less taps to access commonly used features. Most of the new features should be rolling out within days on Android devices running Android 6 and above, or in the case of Android Auto, rolling out to phones and devices will take place later this month.
Hi, this is Joe King talking to you from 5,400 feet above sea level in the high desert of Arizona. The sky is blue, the breeze is comfortable, the clouds are puffy and white, and I really feel sorry for all of you people stuck in the gray canyons of New York, which I miss terribly. In 2011, I bought myself what was a very unusual thing from Toshiba. It was about, seven by 10. I'm not sure of the exact measurement. It weighed a couple of pounds. It had a very high resolution screen and its keyboard was a virtual keyboard. It cost, as I remember, a couple of $1,000 retail. And it ran a thing called Android Honeycomb, and the Honeycomb was very quickly upgraded to Ice Cream Sandwich. I think that Android named its versions things like that because they wanted to really ruin my diet. That was an interesting tablet that I had, and I remember I went down to the New York Amateur Computer Club, and I demonstrated it for them at one of their general meetings, which I think are still held on the first Thursday of every month, only now they're held virtually, and ask Hank how you can get a ticket to them free of charge. Well, if you remember, I once mentioned that my very first computer was a K-Pro. The K-Pro 2 was a solid machine. It was originally built along the requirements of the U.S. Army. It came in what looked to be a bulletproof metal case. It had a 5-inch screen or monitor, which was green and black. It was one color. Taught me what I needed to know about computers and programming, and I was very loyal to it. I was one of the co-founders of the New York K-Pro Users Group. And like all things that come to pass, K-Pro went out of business. The New York Amateur Computer Club absorbed the K-Pro Users Group. and we went on to other things. Well, the same thing just happened. History repeated itself. My first computer was K-Pro, gone. My first tablet was Toshiba, gone. Toshiba just sold out its entire computer division. It was once the number one computer division. Now it's the number zero computer division. I think that Sharp bought it all for a real bargain price. Actually, Hank probably could have afforded it himself. Well, now comes the big question that everybody's interested in. All the stores around are now giving pretty steep discounts on Toshiba product. And the discounts are going to get even steeper as they run out of inventory and buy stuff from the warehouse. So the big question is this a good time to buy a Toshiba? That question can't be answered until the other question can be answered. Is there going to be sufficient parts available to repair your Toshiba? I've had three or four computers die on me over the years, and I never bought parts for them, or at least not proprietary parts for them. If they couldn't be fixed with what I could pick up as on a bargain on the internet, then they weren't fixed. They were thrown away. It was cheaper to buy a new one. I would say if you're good with computers, hardware, if you're like Hank, then by all means, buy a bargain Toshiba if you need it and if you want it. If you're more like me, not so good at fixing things, I would stay away from it. I really would. Well, I wish you goodbye, Toshiba, and I wish you hello, whatever is new around the corner. This is Joe King saying good night.
Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Demise of Documentation. Remember, Steve Jobs said, you don't need documentation because it's so intuitive.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for business. This is where I give you, well, in this case, I'm going to give you even more than 30 years of experience in IT, well, in computers. I'm going to go back in time, and we're going to do just a very quick journey forward to current day, and it's all in regards to one topic. Now, I'm an IT professional, and I got to where I'm at by having a fascination with computers, by reading all kinds of different manuals for software and for hardware and for diving in and just doing some of these things with a manual by my side. Now, I started off years ago. We're talking in the early to mid 80s. If I could get my hand on a computer manual, I would read it. I would read the manuals for the games. Now, mind you, sometimes those manuals were kind of skimpy, but I would learn the different keys for some of the different games, and I would just go through and memorize the pattern. Okay, so to throw this, we're going to hit the J, and then to slice with a sword, we're going to hit the L, and then for this we do that and so forth and so on. And I would look at it and I would piece it all apart and I would try and figure out everything in the book before I dove into the actual software. And I applied this in a number of different directions. We move forward to, this was in about 93. I was hired by a company to put into place their ERP software, their enterprise resource planning software. Actually, it was MRP, manufacturing resource planning, but it's the same concept. And I went through and I was looking at their manual and I was reading through the manual and I started asking questions about what the company was doing. And I realized that the software package that they had purchased was not going to be the right one. It had all kinds of different flaws in thinking. It was built to the software was built to create one of 100 widgets, maybe 1,000 widgets. And I was working for a company that had, well, they had widgets, but there were so many different features to those widgets. Okay, it was a furniture manufacturer. So they had the sofas, and they had 100 different designs, but they would also do custom designs, and they would do those 100 sofas in whatever custom size that you wanted, and they would do it with whatever fill that you wanted, and they would do it also with whatever fabric you wanted, but usually they would rely upon you to supply your own fabric, or actually it was your designer would supply the fabric. So it was very customized. It was not a matter of 1,000 widgets. Or even 10,000 widgets. It was a lot of different individualized, customized items. All right, so that's all another story that just gives you an idea. But I had to study the book. I had to read what was going on with that. And I had to apply a lot of knowledge of what the company was doing. I had to seek it out, and I had to apply it to that software. And I'm like, it's not going to work. So we had to move on. Today, we don't have documentation for most of the software that we receive. When was the last time you opened up a manual for any software package? Well, when was the last time you opened up a manual for anything, really? Steve Jobs, a long time ago, he came out with the computers that he did. And along the way, he said, look at this. It doesn't even come with documentation. We've done away with all of the crazy manuals. It's supposed to be intuitive. It was mostly intuitive. But now everybody is doing this. Everyone has done away with documentation. I have some items here. I'm going to be reviewing some items and doing some technology review, and I'm going to be talking on them. And both of the companies that have sent me information so far, they've sent me their products. I'll tell you, it's two-factor authentication. And they've sent me their two-factor authentication devices. They haven't sent me anything else. Just the two-factor authentication devices. One of them, it was a regular FedEx soft package, and there was nothing in there except for that two-factor authentication device. Okay, great. I'm going to go discover how to use this. I'm going to go discover how to set it up. I'm pretty swift at this. I'm a computer nerd. I will figure this out. But I'm concerned for the people out there that they don't have anything to read. Yeah, there's a lot of different attempts that companies make to make life easier on us. Here, just go to this website. Just go to xyz.com/start. And you do that, and it will ask you a bunch of questions, and it'll go through, and it'll set you all up just fine. There's an app. There's an app that I just tried out recently. It's called Quill. It's your own, make your own will and last testament. It asked me all of 10 questions. It said, hey, we got all of this. We're going to ask you a few questions. Great. It's all done. Wait a second. You didn't ask me anything. Well, you asked me my name. You asked me my wife's name and asked me my son's name. And if we had anybody to execute the will. Wow. I haven't finished off putting it through its paces, but you got the idea there. I'm concerned that we've gone in a direction, though, where if I'm looking down the line, we're dumbing down ourselves by dumbing down the documentation. That's my personal thought. But that's just me, Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Hank, whenever I have a hardware problem, you always tell me to go back to basics. You say, clean everything up down to the very last attachment, last piece of hardware, and then whatever is left, that's what's causing you the problem. Well, that sounds good, but sometimes that is in itself a very hard thing to do. When I got down here to Arizona, I needed a car. There's no public transportation at all. So I bought a car, and the car did not have in it the GPS and the conversations and the Bluetooth and all of that that I expected. But what it did have was the ability to hook a smartphone up to the car itself. And there was a screen on the dashboard that would give you the maps and the directions and all the stuff you were looking for. There was only one minor problem. I couldn't figure out how to work it. So I went back to the dealership, and the salesman was, oh, so very cooperative and understanding. And he said, yeah, a lot of people have this problem. And he whipped a cable out of his pocket and whipped his phone, which was also an Android phone, out of his other pocket and plugged it in and showed me exactly what to do. And it was so simple, even an idiot could do it. So I felt I probably could. I qualified. The next morning when I got in the car, I whipped out the cable, my cable, and I whipped out the phone, my phone, and I plugged everything in. And guess what? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Not even an error message. Nothing at all. It was as if nothing was there. Well, I went along for about a week like that. Oh, incidentally, I pulled out the huge manual that was in the glove compartment. And I did everything that the manual suggested, which was just the same thing that the salesman had done, but step by step this time. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Well, I was at a loss. I didn't know what to do. So when you don't know what to do, that's what you do. Nothing. About a week later, I needed a couple of more cables. My phone turns out to have a Type-C connection instead of the standard USB that I was used to. And I only had the one cable that came with the phone. So I also had two cables that I got a special on. And one of those cables was out in the car. I bought those two cables. They were shipped in from China in a little envelope, and it was two for $10. And that was great, as opposed to one for $15, which the other guy sold it for. But I needed a couple more cables, so I bought them from a place that specialized in cables. They charged more. I got three cables for $15, I think, or $20, or $25. I don't remember what it was. And I pulled out one of those cables, and Joanna said, why don't you hook up the GPS from your phone to the screen, because your GPS is so tiny, and it's, even with the voice, it was not as loud as I might like. So I did, and it worked perfectly, first time out. So what did I think? I thought that maybe, just maybe, the problem was in a cable, not in the phone, not in the Subaru, but in the cable. So I started playing with cables, and I found that all the cables that were really bargains to buy, and I bought several more, the real bargains didn't work. Oh, they worked on the phone. The phone would get charged. The phone would do this. The phone would do that, but it would not connect to the Subaru. The expensive cables did. So I did some research. By research, I mean I plugged it into Google and told them to look up what they could find on it. And what we found was a number of cables from, let's say, from China, Vietnam, Korea. Unfortunately, those were also the cheaper cables. Did not meet the standards, the IEEE standards, and there was something in the standards that was needed in order to connect by USB to the Subaru that weren't needed to connect from the AC connector to the phone. They weren't needed for data between the phone and the computer, but for some reason they were needed between the Subaru USB and my Motorola telephone. Do they still say telephone, Hank? It's a cell phone, showing my age. At any rate, I said to myself, this is something that I didn't know about. And I wonder how many other people don't know about it. I wonder how many other people know when they get intermittent problems, it might be because of the cable. It wasn't consistent. It was intermittent. And that's the worst kind of problem. This is Joe King telling you, be careful of your cables. So long.
Can TikTok be trusted? TikTok went behind Google's back to collect users' MAC addresses for over a year. TikTok has seen its fair share of trouble in recent weeks, from a potential presidential ban to a competing product from Instagram. But the company isn't out of the woods just yet. A new report claims that TikTok has collected unique identifiers from millions of Android users in a move that goes directly against Google's policies for app developers. Over the course of at least 15 months, leading up to mid-November of last year, opening the app would send parent company ByteDance the user's MAC address and device advertising ID before any permission was given. MAC addresses don't change, so collecting them and associating them with advertising IDs could allow app developers and advertising firms to create profiles of consumer behaviors that persist until the user stops using the device entirely. According to the Wall Street Journal, ByteDance employed an uncommon added layer of encryption to shield the practice from Google, which prohibits the collection of any type of persistent device identifier like MAC addresses. And while TikTok said in a statement that the current version of TikTok does not collect MAC addresses, this is still troubling for longtime users of the service. TikTok just shrugged off the whole thing and just stated they stopped. No apology offered. They have lost the public trust.
Smart locks open with nothing more than a MAC address. Researchers demonstrated how remote attackers could exploit UltraLog and steal access keys with minimal effort. A smart lock sold by major U.S. retailers could be opened with no more than a MAC address. Smart locks have slowly been adopted as an intelligent, Internet of Things alternative to traditional lock and key methods to securing property. Complementing other Internet of Things devices, including wireless doorbells, smart locks, and deadbolts, are used by the general public to secure their homes, and they also have business use cases. While convenience is king, such connectivity can also create a new set of security problems. Several years ago, for example, a botched firmware update caused chaos for LockState customers who took to Twitter in their drove to complain that they were unable to remotely control their smart locks and therefore access their properties. Now, lockpicks are being replaced with network sniffers and vulnerability exploits. And in the case of UTech UltraLog, Tripwire researchers have disclosed a misconfiguration error and other security issues that's now resolved that leaked data and allow attackers to steal unlocked tokens with nothing more than a MAC address. Sold by retailers including Amazon, Walmart, and Home Depot, UTech's $140 UltraLog is marketed as a secure and versatile smart deadbolt that offers keyless entry via your Bluetooth-enabled smartphone and code. Users can share temporary codes and e-keys to friends and guests for scheduled access, but according to Tripwire researcher Craig Young, a hacker is able to sniff out the device's MAC address and help themselves to an access key too. Young first started by scouring the Internet of Things search engine, Shodan, for any entries related to UTech and the vendor's use of MQTT, a publish-subscribe protocol found in Internet of Things devices to exchange data between nodes. For example, a smart thermostat sensor could transfer data relating to heating in a particular room, or Smart Lock could use MQTT to record users and their access activities. MQTT record these details under topic names. The researchers' queries reviewed an Amazon-hosted broker containing UltraLog topic names, including customer email addresses. The researcher then examined the UltraLog device itself, which pairs with a bridge device connected to a Wi-Fi via Bluetooth. Young found a repeating message flow on the unlock process of interest, and after knocking up a Python script to replay messages, worked out that the messages could be used to open the lock. All it took was the right MAC address, conveniently leaked via the MQTT data, and also made available via radio broadcast to anyone within range. Young said that this security issue made it easy to steal unlocked tokens either in bulk or from specific devices. The MQTT data correlates email addresses, local MAC addresses, and public IP addresses suitable for geolocation. The researcher says an anonymous attacker would be able to collect identifying details of any active UTEC customers, including their email address, IP address, and wireless MAC addresses. Young reached out to UTEC on November 2019 with his findings, and the company told Young not to worry in the beginning, claiming that unauthorized users will not be able to open the door. The cybersecurity researcher then provided them with a screenshot of the Shodan scrape, revealing active customer email addresses leaked in the form of MQTT topic names. Within a day, the UTEC team made a few changes, including the closure of an open port, adding rules to prevent non-authenticated users from subscribing to services, and turning off non-authenticated user access. While an improvement, this did not resolve everything. The key problem here is that they focus on user authentication, but failed to implement user-level access controls. Young commented that he demonstrated that any free anonymous account could connect and interact with devices from any other users. All that was necessary is to sniff the MQTT traffic generated by the app to recover a device-specific username and an MD5 digest which acts as a password. After being pushed further, UTEC spent the next few days implementing user isolation protocols, resolving every issue reported by Tripwire within a week. Even with safety-critical systems like locks and furnaces, there's little in the way of requirements to make the product secure, and there's even less security oversight. And with other Internet of Things botnets, devices on the Internet do not even need to be safety-critical to wreak havoc when they fail. Tripwire's findings build upon a slew of critical issues discovered in the UltraLog by pen test partners. Last year, the penetration testing company disclosed mobile app API security failures leading to user information exposure, as well as the means to reset lock pins, thereby potentially locking a victim out of their own property or granting attackers access. It was also possible to pick the lock locally over Bluetooth in what the researchers call a trivial attack.
Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation. Marty's always on some projects where he thinks he's finished with the project, but there's always a sequel. He had his hot water tank replaced, and he thought that was done. Now he's got a reversal of fortunes, and it happened within 5 days. What he did and why that any homeowner would want to hear. I don't know. Let's hear about your problems, Marty.
The desk chair at my News Tips basement office is, actually make that was, line of sight with the gas-fueled hot water tank. Most hot water tank failures happen near the bottom of the tank, and you hear the splash of water that hits the floor. Not this one. It happened at the top, around the collar that surrounds the vent pipe. Not quite an eruption. Not quite a geyser. Not quite a gusher. More like a bathtub overflowing. The water spread across the top of the tank, ran down the side, and the floor sounded like an indoor rain shower. Interestingly, the water ran right over the magic marker note on the side that said, "The tank was installed in 2005. What's the first thing you would do? What's the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth? First up, we shut off the cold water intake to the tank. Second, we called plumbers. Third, shutting off the gas. Fourth, running a hose from the tank's bottom spigot to the floor drain. Fifth, opening all the hot water taps in the house. Want to hear those again? Cold water off, plumber, gas off, drain the tank, open every hot water tap. You probably know why. Turning off the cold water denies the leak its supply of water. Calling the plumber? Well, this is not a do-it-yourself circumstance, not when a gas line is involved. The tank had to be emptied, and having gas heat up an empty tank does not have a happy outcome, so turning off the gas was next. Draining the tank, and listen, there's time. You don't have to open that spigot all the way, and you don't want to overwhelm the floor drain. You just want it to be empty before the plumbers arrive. 40 gallons of water. Are you doing the math? Where a pint is a pound and there are 8 pints to the gallon, that's 320 pounds of water that no one can carry up the stairs and load into a truck. Empty? A lot lighter. Opening all the hot water taps lets water that's already in those pipes flow back down to the tank and join what's being emptied into the floor drain. It also opens an air path, like taking your fingertip off the end of a straw that's holding a liquid, so it helps assure the tank will get fully drained, and so will the pipes. That was a Thursday. The earliest appointments we could get were Saturday for an estimate and Monday for the work. Now, this is radio, an audible medium, so you may not be thinking much about your other senses, but reality added up to something unavoidable. A lot of days without a shower. A growing, well, let's say, aroma. Not fun. But all that is just an unhappy background story. That hot water tank was long intended for replacement, though we hoped for more control over the timing. That didn't happen. There were two reasons to replace it, one of which doesn't apply to most of you. This house was built in 1979 and originally had oil heat. You can still see the big round concrete shapes where the pipes entered a chimney. That chimney is using up floor space in the basement, in the middle of the kitchen, and in an upstairs bathroom. And the only reason it had to stay, other than being terribly expensive to remove, was because the hot water flue pipe was using it. Freeing up the chimney was one reason. But the second reason will be more relevant to a lot of you. It's this. Even on gas, a hot water tank is an unnecessarily expensive way to get hot water because it keeps using fuel to keep those 40 gallons hot 24/7. There's a much more efficient alternative. And within its realm, a specific choice with some added benefits, like a strong likelihood it will keep working 2 or 3 times longer than any tank without needing major maintenance or repairs. The alternative, well, broadly, it's a tankless water heater. It works on demand, meaning when any tap needs hot water, the demand for water makes the tankless heater fire up and instantly heat all the water flowing through its heat exchanger to whatever temperature you set. That's not 24/7. That's only when a hot water tap turns on. You're starting to get a sense of the savings, but kick that up a notch. The gas flame heating the water burns at about 400 degrees Fahrenheit, which is hot enough to keep a lot of gallons per minute going without slowing down. And all that heat goes out the flue. And somebody thought, what a waste. The idea evolved into kind of a preheater, where before the incoming cold water goes to the main flame-driven heat exchanger, it runs around the flue where hot gases from the fire bring its temperature up quite a bit. Simply stated, it's like feeding a water heater with warm water instead of cold. At the same time, by the way, when the flue gases pass that incoming cold water, that cools down the exhaust from about 400 degrees to about 120 degrees. The heat difference is used, not wasted. One curiosity in that design is that condensing happens on the water feed at the flue because the water pipes are cooler than the dew point of the gases going by. These two-stage designs are called condensing tankless water heaters. The condensate, this is important, it's extremely acidic. More about that in a minute. It would have been a little less expensive to get a tankless heater and mount it against that chimney and use the flue pipe, but that would be like, well, nailing that chimney into the floor plans forever. Or a tankless heater could mount against the basement wall, which would mean running a new flue pipe up the outside wall of the house. We had a better answer, happily, already on hand. It's an outdoor-mountable condensing tankless water heater, the Noritz. Noritz is N-O-R-I-T-Z. The Noritz NRC98OD. Yeah, this is the Blizzard Belt, but no, we're not worried about an outdoor Noritz freezing in the winter. Its built-in safeguards keep it from freezing unless the temperature drops under 30 below. That's an historically uncommon event here. And this model doesn't need a flue pipe. Its exhaust is only 120 degrees. And even that only happens when hot water is in use. So it just blows out the front of the case. Installing it did mean a lot of changes. A lot of pipes needed to be moved or extended through the sill plate to reach the new outdoor unit. One for cold water, one for gas, plus an incoming hot water line and a condensed drip line, and also a power feed through a new interrupter box and a low voltage signal feed for the control panel. Four plumbers worked before lunch. Then the crew dropped to two after lunch. All were gone and the new water heater working before dinner. The official government yearly energy cost estimate for the old tank was half again higher than the estimate for the new tankless heater. But this is one case where the estimates work in our favor and the savings are even higher. That's because there are just two of us, so the total household water usage is less. And this tech doesn't fire up just to keep a few hundred pounds of water waiting and hot. At the other end of the spectrum, there's no 40-gallon limit on the amount of hot water we can use that's still hot water. For as long as there's natural gas and a working well, we can heat 7.5 gallons of water per minute forever. Two notes about the water itself. One is that you don't want the source water to be overly acidic, and you do want to condition it to prevent scale. That enhances its maintenance-free expectancy. And that highly acidic condensate drip needs specific attention. There's a roughly shoebox-sized product from JJM Alkaline Technology. It's their NBT23 Condensate pH Treatment Tank. And we installed that on the inside wall where it's much less likely to freeze. It's a neutralizing tank with magnesium hydroxide pellets you need to replace every year. Untreated acidic drip can damage sewer lines and septic tanks. You need to bring the pH of the drip to at least 5, which is still quite acidic, but more survivable. PVC piping from the Noritz drip line to the neutralizer and then to the floor drain address those worries. Do make sure the fittings are tight, and do make sure you start with some fresh tap water in that tank. We also added closed-cell foam self-seal insulation to all the basement hot water pipes. Now, there are myths about insulating water pipes. The truth is that the insulation mostly slows their rate of cooling. You don't get instant hot water. You do get a bit of a stretch from the last time somebody was using hot water at any one tap to the next time at the very same tap you turn it on. You could find nearly as hot water flowing. The foam provides R3 insulation, less expensive than you'll guess, and much quicker to install than you fear, but that's without so much as trying to get it around the pipes that go up inside the walls, just in the basement ceiling. So, We're showering again. It smells a little better here. A control panel puts the hot water temperature where we want it, 115 degrees. Because anytime you choose to run cold water because the hot water alone is too hot, you're wasting both. And that's how we got out of hot water and back into it again. Next time, the subject is backup power systems. What kind of UPS you may need, and what kinds probably not. And generators, and why some of them are more about leeching money than about generating juice. And how your needs for any of these have evolved. The segment is called Keeping Your Sockets Out of Your Pockets. Join us and be empowered.
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have been holding their general monthly meetings via teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club listed on our website, pcradioshow.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group, BCUG, will have a presentation on computer gaming for everyone, Thursday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is pcug.com, RSVP for meeting ID. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on connecting Internet of Things to your home or small business network. Thursday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org for RSVP to get a meeting ID. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey. They meet Friday, September the 11th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. Website is acgnj.org, RSVP for meeting ID. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.